Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today, I think we have a very important show, one that's very timely. We're seeing a lot of changes in our society, and the young people seem to have a different frame of reference, I'm noticing, and I don't seem to be able to want to even connect with them. And I'm wondering, as parents, what's it like with COVID and with now homeschooling and all the changes that have happened in our education system? And what are kids learning and what kind of citizens are we producing? It's, I know from our standpoint with adults, it's always about fear, but I'm curious to know what's going on with education of children. I think it's not like children are being taught to be self-sufficient, to be self-reliant. It seems like they're in a bubble, and that's not a good way to be, because you can't adjust and you can't be flexible. And is that the reason that we're seeing, from a medical standpoint, so many young people on anti-anxiety drugs and antidepressants? Is that in any way an outgrowth of what we're teaching them? So today I wanted to have somebody who's an expert come on and talk about what it means to be a parent now in this day and age, and what's going on with the education of our children. So today we're going to welcome Ms. Andrea Keith. She's the vice president for Let Grow, an organization that is in the forefront of what's going on in our health, I'm sorry, in our education system, and I think what parents can do to try to be more proactive. So Ms. Keith, I wanted to thank you so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you on.
It's wonderful to be here.
Well, I'm jumping at the bit to get started. What made you create this organization? Why is there a need for an organization like Let Grow?
Well, I can tell you that this nonprofit was started by a collection of really interesting and amazing people who are highly concerned with the development of children and all of the social emotional skills that we're now teaching in school that we didn't used to teach, and a observation that kids are coming out of high school not really prepared to be adults, not really prepared to handle university, or even just living on their own. And so Jonathan Haidt, who's a research psychologist and wrote The Coddling of the American Mind, and Dr. Peter Gray, who wrote Free to Learn, is also a research psychologist, they got together and decided that something needed to be done. And they connected with Lenore Skenazy, who was originally America's worst mother, for letting her son ride the subway when he was 9 years old, and the founder of the Free Range Kids movement. So what happened was this group got together and decided to create Let Grow, a nonprofit that is absolutely committed to providing tools for parents, educators, and communities to raise independent kids who are really ready to grow up bold and resilient. And they took a number of programs that all of them had kind of started. So Lenore had started a free range project, which is essentially having parents let their kids do something on their own that they normally wouldn't let them do on their own. And so that was a way to allow kids to be a bit more self-sufficient, to develop some self-confidence, and for parents to recognize the capabilities that their kids have. And it's interesting to me because, you know, you mentioned the idea of education and children in a bubble. And I'm really, this is a passionate topic for me, having been an educator and having been a parent and now being involved with the Let Grow organization. I can say that it seems to me we are fairly stuck in this almost hamster wheel kind of situation where kids are kept in a bubble by their parents because of fear of things. Mm-hmm. Let me do that for you, or that, oh, no, that's dangerous. In a way that, I'll date myself, but my generation was not brought up. We spent our time outside with our friends without any adult supervision. We ran around the neighborhood, no cell phones, and mom didn't know where we were. We just had to be home in time for dinner. Mm-hmm. And that meant that we did a whole lot of playing, negotiating, collaborating, working things out with other kids of different ages. And that was a lot of really important social emotional learning that happened for us naturally. And we walked into the schoolroom having had that background. And so now, parents are worried about kids, being hurt. They're worried about kids being kidnapped. Even though crime is at its lowest rate in generations, we have this whole society that is fairly fearful and treats our children as very fragile, not just physically, but also emotionally. We work very hard to shield them from any frustrations or difficulties in their lives. And because we're doing that as a society, and it is perpetuated by the media, it's perpetuated by companies who sell products like, a rubber ducky you stick in the bathtub to tell you whether the water's too hot or not. When, let's be real, before you put that in the rubber ducky in, you've already tested to see if the water's hot or not. And I think that what happens with schools is they get caught up in that whole thing because of the way the parents are requiring schools to address things, or fear of litigation, and a lot of these other types of outside influences that all come together and create this kind of situation where it's very difficult for any one part of this equation to step out of that to do really what's best for the kids.
It seems like there's been just an insertion of regulation and people who, just like in the healthcare profession, people who don't know about what it means to be a teacher and teach kids, just like they don't know what it's like to be a doctor. They're telling you what you should do, what sounds good in a textbook. They know, but they actually don't, and they're making this whole situation worse. And to me, this kind of started, and I'm dating myself too, but we used to play dodgeball. We used to be extremely violent.
I got a concussion playing dodgeball once. Yes.
That was my favorite sport. Nothing like coming up on someone and really just nailing them. But, see, you're the hitter or the hitty. That's really what our mentality was,
Uh-huh.
And you have to deal with it. I mean, when they started removing dodgeball and things that competition and everybody has to be a winner and get a trophy, I started to worry at that point. And I want to know what your take on that is, because it seems to me that was the beginning of everybody's special, everybody's a princess, but everybody's a victim at the same time. It's so bizarre.
I think the whole praising our children for everything they do, I'm not quite sure exactly where that came from. I'm sure it came from really good intentions. And the idea that that children need to have positive reinforcement to build their self-confidence. But I feel like we went off the rails and went way too far to the extreme in trying to make everybody feel equal, feel mm-hmm. that everybody is as good as at everything. And to be honest, that's not true. We all have potential, and some people are going to be really good at dodgeball and throw at people, and other people hopefully will get really good at ducking. So it's really a matter of finding our own way and understanding our own limitations and our own strengths, and then choosing what we want to move forward with. What do I want to be good at? And what do I maybe don't really value quite so much? And so I think that there was a whole lot of psychology. I'm sure we could go back and find a lot of self-help books. The beginnings of, parenting magazines and parenting as this as this job that you're supposed to do right, as opposed to a journey and a learning experience that you go through with your children. And I think that's where things really started. And as soon as we started giving everybody a trophy and telling them they were all wonderful, things went downhill. And kids aren't stupid. The kid who can't kick the soccer ball and got the trophy, you think he doesn't realize that that other kid over there that scores every goal is better at soccer than he is?
Gee, I wonder. Let's think about that and take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Miss Andrea Keith. She is the Vice President for School Programs. People need to go to letgrow.org, and they have a wonderful website where you can read about their mission statement, blogs, and ideas that you have, and also join their mailing list. I think it's very important that people start taking their power back. It's not being passive anymore. It's about engaging. No one's going to want more for your child than you will. And on that note, I'm curious to know what the psychology of the child we just talked about in the first segment. But what about the psychology of the parent? There seems to be something just as nefarious going on there. Like, you want your child to be the best, and these parents do their papers for them. There's all this in some instances, cheating going on, let's be honest, mm-hmm. or beating the heck out of the coach who doesn't put them on the team. Or it's just become almost like a contact sport.
Yes. I think a lot of it has become a matter of competition and shaming. And I think this comes a lot from social media and the internet, frankly. I think there's always been a bit of an expectation to, you know, you want to raise good kids. You want them to, they represent you as a parent, and you want to be proud of them, and you want other people to be impressed by them. And certainly, you know, 1950s stay-at-home moms did everything that they could, that they thought they should, in order to make sure their kids had what they needed. But they did it also by standing back and letting them be independent. I think what happens now is parents are so frequently comparing themselves against each other. They are seeing things on social media, especially when like Facebook first became popular. Everybody put their best foot forward, and everyone was trying to make it look like they had the perfect children, the perfect family. And then add to that, that there is huge pressure for kids to succeed earlier and earlier, because if they don't succeed in preschool, they won't get into the right kindergarten, and then they won't get into the right elementary school, and so on and so forth. And so the other thing that happened is that somehow, and this probably came from some education and higher education types of places, it became the goal of childhood to build your child's resume. And the pressure to make sure that your child has the best resume from the moment they're born is the only way to make sure that you have done it right and succeeded as a parent. And if you don't do that, then you are a failure. And I think that's a message that comes through pretty loud and clear in a lot of different areas, on television, in the news, in media. I mean, just look at the college scandal that the celebrities mm-hmm. were caught up in. Mm-hmm. That came from outside pressure. There is no question in my mind that that's a result of societal pressures that make us think that that's the only route to success for our kids, as opposed to celebrating what your child is good at, their passions, and what they want to do, and recognizing that success is measured in a million different ways. And we can't all be Rhodes Scholars coming out of Ivy League colleges and have a successful society.
Oh, I agree with that. And it's what makes us different that makes us powerful. Mm-hmm. It seems to be, it's all about, you know, conformism and part of the group and the whole. And again, I can use that analogy from a medical perspective. We've gone from being in, you know, professionals, whether you're a doctor or a nurse, now we're part of a healthcare team. And it's just this amalgamation and I think dumbing down, frankly, of the common of the whole. you have to go to the lowest common denominator to make it work, don't you?
That is generally true in almost everything in life, unfortunately.
Well, how do we, I think we've seen the you just did a wonderful job of explaining the negativity. I think people are kind of getting, I hope, tired of this. It's not working. People are more unhappy. People are on more medication. So the only way out, in my opinion, is to celebrate what makes you different, not what makes you the same.
I think that's true. And I think we see there are a lot of people that are trying to do that. I see it, certainly in parents and parenting groups. I see it in communities, and I see it in a lot of schools as well. There's a recognition and an understanding, at least on a basic logical level, that everybody's different, that everybody needs to, be themselves and meet their own personal potential. And that if we're all doing that, there will be the variety of our population to create a wonderful society and keep us moving forward and keep us happy. I think that we know that. How you put that into practice is a bit more difficult, I think. But I see things like, in schools, they are talking about personalized learning. They're talking about how do we let the children have student agency and decide what and how they want to learn. And that is amazing and could be extraordinarily effective. However, it's difficult for a couple of reasons, one of which is that especially public education, which is where I taught and I am a product of public mm-hmm. education. But especially in public education, I think that they get caught up in the machine. It's hard. It's such a systemic way of doing things. And we're so focused on things like test scores and data that we have left behind a little bit the humanity of our mm-hmm. children. And that definitely makes things a little bit different, difficult. And then the other thing that I think really plays a part comes back to this whole idea of independence and letting kids own their own learning. That's a great concept, but it absolutely depends on having children who have a foundation in independence, who already have some self-agency, who can control their impulses, who can set their own goals and organize their time, who solve their own problems and aren't afraid to fail because they've done things like fallen down and gotten back up. And because our parenting style has lost so much of that and replaced so much of child-directed activity with adult-directed activity like sports and tutoring and clubs and all of these activities that parents are driving, or at least before the pandemic, were driving their kids to all the time. And I think that what happens is parents sometimes unwittingly are almost working against some of the things that the school wants kids to be able to do, and probably vice versa.
Give me an example of that. That's fascinating. I would think the parents and the teachers would be on the same page.
Well, they're all on the same page that they absolutely want what is best for kids. But here's an example. As a teacher, I may have a project where the students are supposed to select a topic that's important to them. And, let's say something in nature, maybe. And so the child gets to choose their own thing to work on, and they're going to create their own project with some parameters that the teacher provides. And the idea is the student is able to determine what they're going to do, try what they want to do, decide what it looks like, decide if it's good enough, and all of those types of things. And that's part of the learning process. They can go home, though, and what they get from their parents is, well, what's it supposed to look like? How can you get an A? What can I help you with? And, oh, maybe that's not good enough. And the parents are very well-meaning and trying to help the student. But they're actually, what the student hears in this message is from their teachers, they're heard, okay, you can do this, you figure it out, you're capable, and even if it's not perfect, it's your learning, and it's what's right for you. They go home, and the subliminal messages they're hearing from their parents are, it has to be perfect, you're not good enough, I don't believe that you're capable, and that's what the student hears in their head. And those are the kinds of things that they can internalize. And that can happen the opposite. Parents who build up their children, we're going to go back to those trophies, parents mm-hmm. who build up their children in a way that is excessive and not necessarily grounded in reality can give kids a real false sense of confidence that they take with them to school. And then when they do struggle, they have no idea how to deal with that.
Well, that's a really good point. So is there a minimum age? Because I mean, everything you're talking about, I totally get. And I remember as a medical student, for example, we taught ourselves, the four of us, taught ourselves physiology, a separate group from the rest of the class. And okay. It was awesome. And we were self-motivated. To this day, physiology is one of my favorite things, and I understand it in and out because we had to teach each other. Mm-hmm. But is there a minimum age where that would actually work? I mean, where do you think people should start in terms of the age of being that self-sufficient?
Oh, my goodness. Pretty much by a year old. It's what human beings are designed to do. If you really look at child development, it's really all about becoming more and more self-sufficient. There's no reason that a child of age 3 can't teach their 18-month-old sibling how to do something, either through modeling or specifically showing them how to do that. This is a natural part of learning, and it's a way things happen from an early age. So I would say that the most important thing that we can do is, in an age-appropriate, developmentally appropriate manner, help kids do things for themselves and make that a gradually expanding process so that you start as a young child and maybe at age 4. I remember having my daughter when she was actually 3. I taught her how to get her own snacks out of the fridge. I put them in little muffin tins. So she knew kind of what she had to do. And I also taught her how to press the button on the VCR and start her Disney video. I did this because I had a new baby at home who did not sleep and had some health issues. And it was all I could do to get that last half an hour in the morning because she wanted to get up so early. Well, that's a really simple thing, but it taught her that she had capabilities to do things. And that's the kind of little thing that you do that you build on and on and on throughout their life. So that by the time she goes to college and moves into the dorm, she knows how to do her own laundry and she's comfortable making her own appointments and she can handle all of those daily things. You have to scaffold it and start it very young, is my belief.
Well, what you just described is power. You know, mm-hmm. children have this ability. I got this because I've done it before, or I can think my way into things. I mean, that's really empowering. And if you have that, I think you're less susceptible to peer pressure, mm-hmm. going along, getting along when you know it's not quite right, but you don't know how to get out of it. It's a sense of self. And I think, my God, everybody needs that. I don't think a lot of adults don't have that at this point. We're seeing the ramifications of being, I don't know, noodly, for lack of a better way to put it. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. I really don't know, but I don't want to really tell anybody or show anybody I don't know something. That's a problem. If you don't know, speak up. You know, that's really what it comes down to. And if you don't know, learn it. On that note, let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Miss Andrea Keith. And today, before the break, we were talking about a lot of things that I feel blessed because I was in this situation where my parents did everything that we're supposed to do. I was self-sufficient. I made mistakes. I didn't get coddled, but I knew that they had my back, but if I did something, I have to do a better job of it. You know, it's not someone's fault. Take responsibility. And that's another thing I wanted to ask. What about self-responsibility? What, taking responsibility for your actions, is that something that is integral in helping somebody grow up in a healthy, self-sufficient way?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think we see so much in society now where it's all about the blame game. And I think that by creating people or citizens who point outside of themselves for everything that happens to them, it just isn't good for society. We talk about, Peter Gray uses a phrase that I really love when he talks about free play and how important play is to children in developing their social emotional skills. And he really talks about how free play, unstructured free play, doing things for yourself, trying things, building things, and all of those parts of childhood that are so important help build an internal locus of control. And that an internal locus of control means that you recognize that your actions are your own, that you affect the world around you, that when things happen that you caused, you take that responsibility, you learn from it, you fix it, or you celebrate it for the things that you do well. An external locus of control essentially puts you in a victim mentality all the time. Because that if I'm not in control, then I don't have to be responsible. What I do doesn't matter. Other people are going to make these decisions for me. And you become a fairly ineffective and anxious person. And when you're not given, if somebody isn't telling you what to do or what to think, you have no idea what to do with yourself and you're lost.
Yeah, I think we're seeing that in droves these days. You know, I guess my corollary to that is, what about these video games? If you're not free playing and you don't have an imagination, and let me just give another example. There's a organization here in Georgia that works with children who are developmentally delayed in terms of their education. Mm-hmm. And I was told that when kids, I don't know, they didn't necessarily have a Asperger's or anything like that, but children, the way they're now playing, mm-hmm. they're not able to have an imagination. When I read, I'm not looking at the words at some point, I'm visualizing. Right. They cannot do that anymore. And that's so tragic. So everything is kind of spoon-fed. It's short attention spans, has mm-hmm. to be all these bells and whistles. What kind of damage to the foundation of your, you know, your psyche and your being an adult is affected by all these video games with, God knows, they're telling you the story, right? You're playing out the story as you're playing the video game. You're not interacting with people. You're texting and you're both in the same room at the same, or, you know, friends don't even look at each other. How's this affecting that being able to be separate and independent?
So I think there are two things I'd like to address in that. The first is, I think technology in general has really done damage to all of our attention spans. We have all become completely addicted to instant gratification, be it on social media, be it, you know, getting your phone pings at you to tell you this or that, and notifications all over the place. We have television and things like that that are getting shorter and shorter. The shows are shorter. The commercials are longer. You don't have to think about things too much. You're getting snippets on YouTube, and don't even get me started on TikTok. But all of these different things are playing into adults as well as kids. And there are jokes that, oh, you know, my child was born with a phone in her hand. We give devices and we put screens in front of our children at earlier and earlier ages. And it's not that our generations didn't do that. I grew up on Sesame Street and Electric Company and Mr. Rogers and Captain Kangaroo. So it's not that I didn't have exposure to television. And I'll admit it, I'm sure sometimes my mom was using it as a babysitter. And I honestly think that that's just human and real. But I think we've become so reliant on these devices that it shortens all of our attention span. And that's damaging to our children. And not only do they do it themselves when we hand them the device, they see us doing it. And we can't hold our attention. We can't put our phones down for 10 minutes and really focus on what our kids are saying. So I think that's part of the issue. I would also say I have a little bit of a different take on video games. Part of it, I think, comes from having a son who was on Nintendo when it first came out. And I watch my son, who's now 26 years old, and he's a very successful and in law enforcement. I watched him kind of gradually grow as the technology and the video games changed. And one of the things that I think we have to recognize is, on the one hand, yes, spending all of your time playing video games, we're losing the whole social connection and kids interacting with each other. Now, it's easy to say that right now in the middle of the pandemic, because that, of course, suddenly forced everybody to be inside and not interact in physical ways. So that's definitely a concern. But I find that depending on the video games and the child, some of those video games are actually replacing some of the free play that we talked about. Mm-hmm. When we were young and we went out and we made up a game that was essentially, you know, capture the flag, but we had all these different rules and it was, you know, maybe we were set. It was like, okay, we're in space or whatever. We used our creativity. We used our imagination. We negotiated, we formed teams, we worked with each other and tried to reach common goals. And to an extent, a lot of that is actually present in today's video games. I don't necessarily agree with all of the violence that's in some of them, but if you actually really sat down and listened and watched a group of friends in their own homes, all on the video game, as a team working together against other people who are in their teams, you would see a lot of those skills being brought into play. So I hate to paint anything with too broad a brush, because I think there is some good in some of that. And I think it does give the kids, they're all on headsets now, they're talking to each other in ways that I think is it ideal? No, but I will tell you this. I don't remember where the information came from, but there was a survey that was done with kids. And when asked if they would rather be inside playing video games or outside playing with their friends, a huge majority said outside playing with their friends. The problem now is nobody's allowed to go outside, or they're home by themselves after school and they're basically not allowed to go out. So they're doing the next best thing.
Gotcha. So let's take a separate tact and talk about how society is kind of penning in parents and children. You mentioned at the beginning that there is this overprotection and parents are afraid because of safety issues with being, God knows what happened to your child, or, you know, getting hurt and being in a, you know, a cushion playing any kind of contact sport.
Right.
But did that happen first, or was it society coming at the parent for, you know, child protection and having your home visited, like recently on a homeschooling with a kid having a BB gun in his background? And basically I don't know if CPS came to visit, but it was certainly frowned upon. So it's outside in too, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I wish I could answer that question, because I think it's a classic chicken and egg dilemma. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to pinpoint what started some of this. But I know that we are especially concerned with the idea that parents are being restricted by laws, by fear of judgment, and being afraid of having, you know, child protective services called. And I think that we have all gotten, it's a strong word, but there's a whole lot of righteousness that's going on in society. And I don't know exactly where it comes from, but there are huge amounts of shaming, parent shaming, mom shaming. It's a thing. And I think because we it's much easier to point at other people and point out what we think is a problem with easy black and white definitions. We at Let Grow, we have information on different states and the laws they have regarding things like letting kids play outside by themselves, or, you know, at what age can a child walk to the park and play with their friends and have it not be neglect. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge issue. So I think what we have is we have a lot of parents who maybe want to change how they're doing things, but they have the fear that somebody else will report them. And once you get involved with Child Protective Services, you are in trouble. It is not easy to get past that, because there's a lot of assumption that if you've been reported, then you're not a good parent, and their whole investigation is based on, do we need to take your children from you? Instead of giving people the benefit of the doubt,
right,
that they're doing the best for their kids, and that everything that you do is not something that has to be judged and approved by all of society. We all do things a little differently, and that's okay. And parents are, this makes me laugh. You're a doctor. Mm-hmm. It's called practicing medicine.
Yes.
Well, it should be called practicing parenthood too, because you're constantly learning. You're constantly adjusting. You're trying things that didn't quite work, so I'm going to tweak this or tweak that. There is no one manual for parenting that works for every parent and works for every child and creates the same results.
Oh, I think you said a mouthful there. Let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living a Solution. We're speaking with the Vice President for School Programs, Ms. Andrea Keith of Let Grow. And again, people need to go to letgrow.org to their website, join their mailing list, and read their webpage, because there's a lot of information. The Let Grow project, the Free Play project. These are things that I think they were excellent ideas. I don't understand why schools don't do it. And, you know, ultimately, it really comes down to the parent, doesn't it? I'm a big proponent of, as the people of this country, we have the power. The government works for us. So why couldn't it or shouldn't it be the same thing for parents who want this for their children?
I think that what we're seeing, there are a number of schools that are incorporating Let Grow's programs. We're a fairly young organization, and to be perfectly honest, up until they hired me in December, they didn't really have anybody focused on the school programs. They recognized that the programs that they had, which are essentially designed to help change parenting, work very well in school programs, because that's where the parents are. If we really want to get information out to parents, our schools are really the first place that can share things like this. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we are working very hard to get this information out there. Pretty much anybody I ever talk to on the education side says, oh my gosh, you're right. This is the kind of thing that needs to happen. It's ridiculous how simple this is. And, you know, we provide our implementation guides for free. They're easy to do. They don't take a bunch of resources or time from teachers out of the classroom day. And it has really powerful effects. So I think at this point, what we see is some grassroots happening from teachers. We have a lot of individual teachers that are also parents and subscribe to Let Grow and share these types of things. We're working hard to get the word out to administrators, to schools and districts. We have some districts that have done this for a couple of years and they have nothing but good things to say. They see huge improvements in confidence. They see the kids become much more capable at school, less likely to have their parents helping them do their work, less likely to stress out and get anxious about whether what they're doing is perfect. So they're really seeing the benefits. And so for us, it's really a matter of just getting the word out that this is out there and this can be done. And I'll be honest, the pandemic kind of threw a little bit of a kink in our works, in my plans when we first started looking at how to get this out into more schools. And yet on the other hand, in some ways there was a bit of a silver lining, because what we saw with everybody suddenly at home was that kids needed something to do. They were bored. They needed, you know, what are they going to do? The parents, a lot of them were working if they were out as, you know, on the front lines, or if they were, you know, not working or working from home, they were in a situation where like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with these kids who normally are scheduled from dawn till dusk? Mm-hmm. And so we were able to get the Let Grow project through a lot of parents as well. It's called the Independence Kit, is a version of the project that is designed for a parent to do on their own. But I can say also that we have a lot of parents and PTA representatives that bring this to their schools. And I don't think there's anything subversive about doing that. I think when parents recognize that there's something that the school can support and that the parents can also do, and get everyone on that same page and celebrate it within the school and promote it as an ongoing, regular type of thing, it can really change the culture of the school. And it really helps the parents as well to recognize and see the success that their child can have, even if it might not be typical academic success. You know, learning to cook and being really good at that, or building things, or other skills that maybe you're not a great student because you're not real good at compliance or test taking and those types of things. That doesn't mean you can't be a highly successful adult.
I agree. And an entrepreneur and have mm-hmm. your own business. And, you know, everybody has value. It's not one way to do anything. I think that's really key. And from a health perspective, imagine if you have your children, because I think some schools got rid of physical education altogether. Mm. So are we seeing the obesity and the diabetes and all these adult diseases showing up in teens as an outgrowth of this? You have to have some sort of outlet. This is the time that people are growing exponentially from a physical standpoint, mental. I can't imagine having to sit in a seat for 7 or 8 hours a day. No wonder the people can't pay attention and are. That was the bet. You learned the most after gym because you had gotten it all out of your system and you could sit and study, right?
Well, and I have to tell you that, you know, PE has still been around. And honestly, I always hated PE. I didn't mind the game playing, but you know, don't make me do push-ups and things like that. I really hated it. But I think what it really comes down to is how important recess and play before and after school is. Our play club, that's what it's all about. It's about opening up the playground and the gym before school starts and after school's over to be able to have that unstructured free play. Because you know what kids do when they play on their own? They run around. They are active. They very rarely sit down in a circle and have a discussion. They're very active naturally. And I think a lot of the health issues that we see may be even more attributable to that change in childhood, where kids aren't out running around and just playing on their own and, you know, falling down in a heap at the end of the day because they played so hard. Mm-hmm. I do think that recess is something that schools struggle with. Again, that comes down to that huge pressure for higher test scores. We have to have, you know, rigor in our curriculum, and we are expected to teach these kids so many different things. And if they're behind, as many of them do become, sometimes from the moment they walk into kindergarten, then they're spending even more time trying to get caught up. And so we have seen a decrease, not in all schools, but in many schools, we've seen a decrease in the time allotted for recess. We've seen recess change from multiple grades out on the playground, kind of doing what they want, to very regimented, you play this game here with these rules. You play that game there with these rules. You older kids, you stay in your area. The younger kids stay in their area, or they're not even on the playground at the same time. And that really has changed the value of those types of things. So absolutely, there's a whole lot of recess and free play, especially for boys, that could probably help a lot with the levels of ADD, ADHD, and all the kids that are medicated for those kinds of things because they can't sit still.
I agree. And I wonder if the explosion of ADHD diagnosis is because kids have pent-up energy. There's no blood test for it. It's just a clinical diagnosis. And, you know, from a parent, and I wouldn't say versus teacher, but there seems to have been a movement of power away from the parent to the school. They become socially more dominant. They're literally raising children, telling them how they're supposed to think. And in some instances, I think, work against their parents. So when did that happen? And I think that something that should be addressed, don't you? If you come back and you're snitching on your parents because they didn't recycle something because of global warming or whatever, that's an issue. I think that's a way to break the family. And I know it's a different argument or a different take, but it's still your children, it should be the parent, in my opinion, that has the bulk of the power on how that child is raised.
You know, that's a really interesting perspective, and I'm going to respectfully disagree with you to an extent. I agree that parents absolutely need to raise their children, and I don't think there's anybody in education that doesn't agree with that. I think there has been a lot of frustration potentially on educators' parts as parenting has changed and my kid is special, and you know that trophy attitude translated into a lot of parents fighting battles for their kids and going to school and arguing that they should have had an A, not a B, or you know, this upset my child and I don't want him to have to learn about it. I think there's some of that coddling that has happened that has frustrated a lot of teachers. Because what's happened is we're not working together. I think that the real key to raising these kids right is to really make it a partnership. What's happened, I think, in a lot of cases is as much as it seems like schools may be dictating opinions or philosophies and things like that to the parents, I think there is a lot of abdication in some ways, as it's seen by the educators, of parents, because all of a sudden, well, why is it the school's responsibility to teach X? Mm-hmm. It used to be it was academics, and now the schools are teaching everything from health and sex ed and the social emotional learning. As much as I feel that social emotional competencies are crucial and key skills for all of us, and a lot of us are lacking them, and I get why schools are starting to try to bring that into their curriculum. But my concern is, why do they need to bring that in their curriculum? And if that is because kids aren't getting that type of independence and that natural learning in their childhood, which, and outside of school time, they're outside of school the bulk of their time as kids, then we've gotten ourselves into this situation where we want somebody to do it for us as parents because it's hard, frankly, and because we don't necessarily know how to do it. So on the one hand, we're like, yeah, well, isn't it the school's responsibility to make sure my child knows X or behaves this way? But the schools are also saying the same thing about the parents. And so I think we get back into that kind of blame, and you know, it's hard to figure out whose job this is when I think it really is all of our jobs. And if we can figure out how to partner in a more effective way for our kids, then I think that that respects everybody's knowledge. Parents know their kids better than anybody, absolutely. But teachers know teaching and teachers know education, and they know our kids in a very different way than parents necessarily do. We talk about how the true test of whether you're a good parent or not is how your child acts when you're not around. Right? I mean, that's fairly true. Well, that's fairly true in education too, because what you'll find is kids will often be very different at school than they are at home. Frequently because they either feel more free or because the expectations are different. And so I think so long as we feel this tug of war, it's not real. It's not a real tug of war. We all want what's best for kids. There isn't a teacher out there who went into this and said, gosh, I want to be a teacher because I can boss kids around, tell them what to do, and, you know, I'll feel powerful. That's not when teachers go into it. And parents don't say that when they decide to have children either. We all really love our kids and want them to be successful in the best way possible. The intentions are always from a good place.
I think that's just beautifully said, and I have to agree. My mom was a teacher as well, so I have a special love and connection, and I wouldn't be sitting where I am now had I not had awesome teachers. On that note, we have to end the show, unfortunately, but how can people reach you?
Well, they're absolutely welcome to, as you said, go to letgrow.org. I'm also happy to talk with anybody who's interested in exploring this more or interested in our school programs. My email address is Andrea, A-N-D-R-E-A, at letgrow.org. And I'd be happy to hear from anybody who listens to this.
Well, I want to thank you so much. I had a great time and I learned a great deal. And I know my listeners did as well. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you too, Elena.
And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.